The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to this special Sunday Space Show program. Thanks for tuning in. I know it's a little early for our normal program. But nevertheless, I promise you, you're not going to regret it. We're in for a great show and a great ride. A couple of quick announcements. We are introducing new ways for you to listen to the live stream of the Space Show. And they are actually in place this morning. And all you need to do is go to thespaceshow.com, our main website page, click on Listen Live, and you will see all the various options and the different streaming services. If you have any problems, you need to let me know at drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you would like to call the program today, that toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And then if you want to email rather than use a telephone, it is dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for those of you that use Instant Messenger or ICQ or CompuServe as a chat program, that screen name is all one word, Space Show Chat. When you're at our website, check out the comprehensive newsletter. It is uploaded every Monday and modified during the week as necessary. It has all the current news, special events, and the coming events for the Space Show. If you want the short version emailed to you, then go visit, just send an email to Dr. Space and we'll be happy to do it. The new listening instructions will also be in the newsletter, so you can check that out as well. And then the archives are there. That hasn't changed. Everything since January is MP3. Everything before January is Windows Media File, and we're podcasting since May 1. The Space Show store has finally expanded. Check it out. We've even got things for your pet there. And then I usually say support the Space Show, right, and ask all of you to go and click on that. Instead, I'm asking all of you to think really long and hard and seriously about contributing to your favorite credible, reputable organization, relief agency for Hurricane Katrina victims. We'll worry about Space Show funding later on. Right now, the people who are in the hurricane zone need help, and I want to see Space Show listeners go and do that. I made my contribution to the Salvation Army. Whatever organization works for you, go for it. Please do that, okay? And I have heard from a couple of Space Show listeners who are in the New Orleans area. They are all fine. They're helping out in the relief efforts. Some of them are very technologically oriented. They're setting up special database servers to try to help people find their relatives. And there's a lot of work going on down there. And we thank our Space Show listeners for helping out and doing that, specifically Theron Lutz, who has been a guest on the Space Show earlier this year. On to our special program today. We are most fortunate to have with us, hopefully I'll get his name right, Anthony Dignan Cabrera, and he is, I can hear him laughing, so I already botched it, right?
That's okay.
This is my Oklahoma ear and twinge.
I don't even get it right on Monday morning.
Anthony is responsible for editorial oversight for space.com, livescience.com, and custom publishing of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. In addition to his daily management of the editorial team, he is instrumental in expanding the consumer media portfolio and developing customized editorial packages on behalf of major sponsors. Under his leadership, Space.com was awarded the 2003 Online Journalism Award for Breaking News by the Online News Association for its coverage of the Columbia Space Shuttle disaster. He joined the company in 1999 from Good Morning America, where he was a segment producer. He has extensive experience producing, writing, and reporting for various news organizations. He was a correspondent with People Magazine's New York Bureau and a staff writer for the Miami Herald. He also reported for ABC, Newsweek, Entertainment Weekly, Biography Magazine, and Life. He studied journalism right here in the area where I live at San Francisco State University. Welcome to the Space Show, Anthony. How are you?
Great. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And I'll just do first name since I've already done a number. Tell us your last name so we get it correct for the record.
My full name is Anthony Dignan Cabrera.
Okay. Well, I apologize.
That's okay.
What is it like being with Space.com versus, say, ABC, Good Morning America?
Well, I think it's been exciting. It's been, in a weird kind of way, I kind of stumbled onto it, as opposed to a lot of people who I found in the space journalism profession who have come forth and came forward with a love of space. You know, I have the honor and the privilege to work with long-term space, aerospace writers, and NASA watchers like Leonard David, and our sister publication Space News with Lon Raines, and people like that. Andy Chaikin was a staff writer and editor on Space.com in the early years of the company. So I've been very fortunate to work with these people, but I came a different route. excuse me. I have always loved space, and I used to get mocked ridiculously in high school because I took the day off school to watch the space shuttle launch, the first launch, and as you know, it was delayed by 24 hours, and I couldn't get the next day off. So the next day the space shuttle launched, but all my friends in school made fun of me because they were like, oh yeah, you were sick, you were watching the space shuttle, and it never went. So there's a history, my history with the space shuttle is long and storied, of it not living up to its potential to a certain degree. But I left that after a while. I've always kept space as a kind of on the hobby side. It's something that I'm interested in. I did a lot of straightforward mainstream news. And after years of doing that and doing some a lot of entertainment news, actually, for People Magazine and stuff for Entertainment Weekly, it was nice to actually find something that was as exciting and I think during this time in our country's history that is based on fact, that it doesn't have all the trappings of entertainment, which really is nothing more than, well, entertainment, and it's really, it's informative. It's powerful for our country's future. It's a really fulfilling experience because it has to do with people's ambitions and dreams, not only as individuals but as a nation. And it's just an exceptional time to be doing it, and it's an exceptional place to be. So I really like it.
when you're with a big news service like the ABC program, do they really care about space? Is it just like a thumbnail compared to everything else? I guess where I'm trying to go is, does the media play any kind of a role at all, the mainstream media play any kind of a role at all in dumbing us down about space or helping contribute to a lack of real interest in space or anything like that?
It's part of the problem. I mean, it's really part of the problem. I mean, over at, an example is, CNN has Miles O'Brien. Space is always on the front burner for because Miles O'Brien is a big space nut. He's passionate about it. He's brought that affection, that passion to coverage at CNN. But MSNBC on the air, they don't have a Miles O'Brien to do that. And Fox, to a certain degree, it doesn't either. So, I mean, it really is, if you have a strong personality or a strong producer who's working on a television show, whether it's a news program in the morning or a 24-hour cable service, I mean, you really need a champion. Now, of course, when the Columbia disaster occurred, how could everyone not look at it? And that's part of the problem because news, the adage for news is, if it bleeds, it leads. So suddenly, people who wouldn't have given thought twice about space or the space program or who gave up caring, suddenly everyone's an expert on what's wrong with NASA, what's wrong with the shuttle, and suddenly everybody's on top of it. But really, the amount of people in news organizations who are committed to covering NASA and to a greater or lesser degree, covering space exploration on an international level is really kind of small.
when President Bush in January of last year announced his space exploration vision, where we're finally headed back to the moon, going on to Mars, did that change anything, or was it just a momentary blip?
It was a momentary blip, because I think that it seems to have been test marketed to the public, specifically through what could be considered organs of the conservative view of the United States, the National Review, and then the New York Post, which is owned by Murdoch, who owns Fox. So it was kind of test ballooned, and it just seemed to in a weird way come out of nowhere, and I think a lot of people, and some people in Washington, believe that it was brought forth because they needed to respond to China's successful first manned launch.
What about a year ago, the success of Spaceship One? Did that change anything or influence anything, or did that too turn out to be a momentary blip?
I think to a lot of people in the public, until there are more Spaceship Ones or more successful or Spaceship Twos that actually, it's still a novelty. It was a novelty. For those of us who are space watchers, for those of us who are space advocates, for those of us who believe in a kind of a future where humanity is colonizing the moon, the asteroids, building space stations and whatnot, we kind of believe that, oh, this is it. This is, you know, this is the first step of creating a viable, you know, industry, and soon, you know, we'll throw off the shackles of government and red tape, and we're going to get out there into the universe. Well, that's nice, but it really didn't go that far, and it really can't get you into orbit. And so I think to a certain degree right now, to the mass public, it's still novel. The Spaceship One was novel, was a novelty.
So what will it take? I mean, like, Spaceship One really was monumental, and of course for the space world, it was jam-packed with people and news energy, and, you know, all the networks were down there in Mojave, and we covered it live for 4 hours for each program on this program, and we were interviewing some of the celebrities that were there, and, I mean, the place was, you know, jam-packed. It was almost like the Academy Awards.
No, it was a very popular event. It was amazing, and they did something amazing. We understand this to be true, that, you know, basically private backing, using new technologies or technologies that have been built upon from the past, created a suborbital vehicle that got into space three times. Well, if you count the test, plus two out of three.
Three times.
Successfully did it without killing anybody. They did an amazing thing. And it shows that it can be done. But ultimately, the impact is only going to be felt if there is a purpose behind it. If there is a purpose beyond giving incredibly wealthy people joyrides in space for 10 minutes. If the American public says, you know what? If they can see that, wow, that gives new meaning to the word business class. I can take a suborbital hop from L.A. to New York in 40 minutes. That's great. Or, you know, if Federal Express licensed the technology, and instead of overnight air, if you drop it off in the morning, it gets to New York in the afternoon. See, that's what's needed. What's needed is that if the application of the technology offers something that the American public and the public anywhere on the planet can buy into and go, oh, we need this. This is making our way of life better, and it's really enhancing the values of our lifestyle and our civilization. But I think right now, it's leaning towards, and maybe this is the important part of it. Maybe it's like, you know, the barnstorming days of the early 20th century when, you know, Playboy flybys, you know, were going around with their airplanes. That maybe it is a gift for the wealthy, first off.
Does the space exploration vision, as it's evolved a year plus after the president announced it, does it bring the people into the program in a way that makes it relevant and meaningful for them? I mean, I know we're not about to have Federal Express of space delivery, or we're not about to be able to jump on a transportation vehicle to go from L.A. to New York in 40 minutes. But are we succeeding with the space exploration vision, or how do you see it?
Well, I think we kind of got a – the space shuttle Discovery mission was a success. You know, the crew went up, they performed some amazing firsts in orbit to maintain the vessel and to make sure that the orbit and reentry was flawless. And in an odd way, they failed to sell that to the public. In fact, the armchair quarterbacking that came from a lot of the mainstream press the next day was they spent millions of dollars and foam came off the tank. Now, even though NASA from the get-go, and I give them a lot of credit for this, they said these are test flights. We have made this as safe as we think we can, and this is a test flight to see if it works. But after they successfully got up there, after they successfully did these spacewalks underneath the vessel, the 360-degree rollover of beautiful flying by Eileen Collins, after all these amazing things and the safe return of the vessel to Earth, it's considered a kind of embarrassment in a weird kind of way. Everyone could only complain about the fact that the foam came off, and they forgot that this was a test mission, that that NASA had gone back to every space shuttle flight will be treated like a test mission because these vehicles, you know, we became kind of intellectually lazy about how we handle these launches, and we're not going to do that anymore. And so there was a disconnect. They were not able to sell to the public that this was a success, and we should be overjoyed that this crew came back to Earth safely.
And here we are, you know, about to spend billions to make this happen, make new contracts with companies, redesign the shuttle into a heavy lift cargo vehicle and a modern day larger Apollo capsule. Are we on the right track?
I don't know. There's many who will argue that yes, we are on the right track. That you know, reusing technologies that we have to keep costs down and only taking aspects of that that we have that actually work. You know, the solid rocket boosters idea seems to be really coming to the head as the way of getting the crew exploration vehicles into orbit. That seems to be fine, but the other side is, well, are they doing this because it makes sense and it's practical, or are they doing it because the congressmen and senators from the different parts of the country where these parts are built don't want to lose jobs, potential voters?
What do you think?
Oh, I'm leaning toward this kind of some murky middle ground between the two. Because there's, you know, these ideas, they're not innovative, they're practical. They're not doing anything new. There's no groundbreaking technology being created to do this. It is recycling, and maybe they are recycling the best and the safest. But are we actually expanding our innovative ideas? Are we flexing that intellectual muscle that was needed to be flexed? Because remember, they were solving problems that never existed when they first did Apollo and Gemini and Mercury and all those. And now you wonder, well, where is the creativity? Where is the genuine push to do what no one has done before again? And I think that's what's kind of missing from this whole vision. This whole vision thing, to quote the previous President Bush.
Bill in San Diego has this question for you. Can we actually afford to implement the Space Vision program based on creating new and exciting technologies and going where no one has gone before, as you're suggesting, or can we only afford to do it by relying on the proven and the true and returning to technologies that work and that will be overall less costly to develop and implement?
I think that we can, if we rely on what we've done so far and do different iterations over it and rework it so we can get up to the International Space Station and back to the moon. Yes, that's fine. I think there's a possibility we can do it. But if you really want to expand the horizons and take the kind of risk, to me there's a certain risk aversion to recycling all the stuff that we've done before. But risk is money. And, I mean, the aerospace industry has been so monopolized and gobbled up over the years, so there's only like a big three or big four, that, you know, they don't want to fork out money. Experiments are costly. If you invest in a new technology, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it doesn't work, well, you're out profits from 1 year. So there's no impetus. There's no reason why the Boeings, the Lockheed Martins, any of these companies actually want to take that kind of risk. And there's so few of them that there really is no, there's no real competition. You know, if one company loses out on a contract, then they form a partnership to do it again. You know, it's like there's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to look. I mean, do we need more SpaceX companies like Elon Musk? Do we need more Spaceship Ones? Yeah, we need more of those. I mean, but even more important We need the government who basically this national space presence who believe in those companies and allow them to get a piece of the pie. And part of that thing goes into, do the big aerospace companies want those little companies to get a piece of the pie?
No, probably not.
Probably not. So, I mean, it's the grand bureaucracy that this country has become, and it's kind of the power of big industry and its relationship with big government. You know, it's like some of these companies, it's like the worst kind of corporate welfare. You know, it's appalling.
But if Boeing or Lockheed were to do experimental or revolutionary work related to the vision, doesn't it get paid for by some sort of government contract, so it's not a risk to Boeing or Lockheed?
Well, I think it's a limited risk for them. But I mean, right now there's pressure to get results. There's this vision that has a timetable that things need to be done. So it's kind of they're going to take the chances that they're going to take a risk and then make a deadline. You know, I mean, we take a risk which could push the deadline, or we take what we know and we make the deadline and not lose any money. What are we going to do?
This is a question from Sally in Austin, Texas. I'm a member of several space advocate organizations, and all of the organizations, from what I can tell, are seemingly on the same page in really advocating and pushing forward for the implementation of the vision, at least in some general format. Yet I don't see our advocate organization message reaching much of the general press, nor do I see it catching on outside of the space community. What should be happening in order to get our message and excitement outside our own community?
Well, I think I'm going to honestly say this is difficult for me to answer that question to a certain degree. And part of the reason is I have a professional relationship of Space.com and Imagine Nova Corporation, the parent company. We have a professional relationship with the National Space Society, one of the leading space advocacy groups in the country. And they give us their content. It appears on a subsection of Space.com. We also are the editors and publisher of the National Space Society's quarterly magazine, Ad Astra. But my feeling is that we did that relationship with them to help them get their message out. I just heard recently that I believe they had a 15% increase in membership since our relationship began, which was January of this year. And that's good. I think a lot of that had to do with their content appears on space.com. We have syndication partners with MSNBC, Yahoo, CNN, and those people, we are able then to get the word out by these organizations onto the Yahoos, out to the CNNs, and then people link back, find out about the National Space Society, and then if they're so inclined, they join. You know, and that's interesting. But the thing is, what are you trying to tell? What a lot of people, and I learned this about space in the 5 years, almost 6 years that I've been at space.com, what I learned is that people, you know, when you think about the year 2000, everyone's going to be, where are the flying cars, you know, we've gone to the moon, where's the space stations, you know, oh, everyone thought we'd live in a Barbarella-type existence and it'd be great. But, you know, the 21st century began and there were no flying cars. But we live in a world where last year, you know, 2004, 2005, you could sit down on a Sunday afternoon making pancakes watching a firefight in Iraq take place in real time sent to you by satellite. That's the space age world we live in. And I think that's the problem. It has become part of our infrastructure, satellite technology, GPS in our cars. People don't see it. They see the applied applications of what we've learned from the space race. But it's been subsumed. It's kind of like cable television. Or, you know, or we see things people take for granted, you know, the power. Or, you know, the water system. And because of that, people don't see the risk. They don't see the need to take the grander risk. And it's up to the advocacy groups to what are you selling to the public? Because, I mean, that is your product. If you're the Planetary Society, if the Artemis Society, if you're the National Space Society, what are you trying to sell to the public? What is the message you want to get across? And it's on different levels. Is it we need to go back to space because it's humanity's desire to explore? That one really doesn't hold a lot of water.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
It doesn't. It's kind of it's presuming that people are not navel-gazing and worried about their wife, their kids, that pretty girl down the street. It presumes that, you know, every now and then somebody sits back and goes, I wonder and lust for the universe. Well, a lot of people don't. I know I don't, and I work for space.com. You know, you gotta be out there. There's so many different levels. There's the intellectual fights that are going on right now about intelligent design and creationism in the schoolroom versus our science and math scores in the toilet compared to what they were 20 years ago. There's, you know, what is the business upside of going into space? There are different parts of the argument, and they have to, you know, it's kind of, you can't be myopic. You can't be, oh, we have to go to Mars because. That doesn't really work. You have to be able, these advocacy groups have to be able to pick a topic and make a game plan and become part of a larger organization that may not even have anything to do with space, but maybe can be concerned about like similar issues, like the quality of education, the brain drain in the sciences, you know, and then move forward from that. Because right now, if you're just focused on one thing, I want to go to the moon, or I only want to go to Mars, or, you know, everyone should go to space because in the future we'll be able to clone on other planets, you're speaking inside a box to fellow travelers, and the person outside with the passing interest, the mother and father who's worried that their children are not going to get enough science education or worried about their futures, don't see it. They're not connecting. And so that's what I think the advocacy groups really have to do, is to find alignment, not only within the different advocacy groups, but without that, to other groups that are in interested in things like the quality of education and whatnot. And I think that's the only way they're going to be able to do it, is look beyond, you know, your dreams and look at other people's dreams and find common ground. And then from then you can sell your product.
You know, you mentioned intelligent design, and actually I'd like to talk to you about that.
I've actually just joined the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And I'm now a pastafarian. I've done it.
You've done it.
I've done it.
Well, we'll talk about it more when we come back from the break, but one of the advocate organizations, and I'm not going to name the one that I'm a member of, actually somehow got to an email sort of bulletin board discussion about intelligent design and creationism, and it was based upon a CNN poll that they were running on their website several months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the traffic that came in on that was probably at least 50% in support of intelligent design and not, you know, really saying that it should be excluded from teaching in our public schools. And they had lots of justification. And then occasionally someone would send in a note, you know, speaking in one short, terse, long sentence, this is nonsense, or this is BS, or this is whatever, or this is not science. And then the response to that would be, you know, pretty overwhelmingly damaging. How dare you speak like that? More than likely, there's no way to do any kind of polling to see how scientific this was in terms of the organization's membership interests. People who want to support it are more likely to probably be using the email commentary than other people. But I watched it from the sidelines. I didn't participate in the discussion. But, I mean, I don't think you could get an advocate organization to team up with an organization saying, you know, increase the quality of science and don't support this in our school systems and stuff like that. Based upon what I saw, the organization is